Okay, we're gonna start again. Appreciate everybody being patient with our break. We will still try to be as close to staying on schedule as possible. Next up, I believe, as we move into the 11 o'clock hour on the agenda, is the discussion further of the Common School Fund. And I think, looking at your notes, Paul, we start with the folks from the Division of State Lands. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right. We would invite them to come forward. I'm sure you enjoyed the great degree of fascination discussion that took place earlier.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jeanette Holman, the Assistant Director for Budget and Administration for the Division of State Lands. With me is Steve Purchase, the Assistant Director for Field Operations and an old hand at State Lands. As many of you know, I'm relatively a newcomer over there. So, and Don Arnold is here from the Department of Justice, and I believe he's going to follow us with some legal discussion. We've been asked today to primarily give you an overview of the background information on the Common School Fund. I brought the Revenue Office yesterday a large portfolio for you to peruse at your leisure as you start thinking more about the Common School Fund. What I'm doing today and what Kim is distributing is some of the high points from that material that I gave you yesterday. I also would urge you at the beginning that if as you go through that material after the meeting and have any questions, please do give us a call. We'd be more than happy to answer any questions that occur to you after today's meeting. The Common School Fund was established by the Admissions Act and the Oregon Constitution as a trust for the exclusive benefit of Oregon's K through 12 schools. In managing the trust, the trustees, which is the state land board, have to consider the benefit provided to both today's children as well as future generations of school children. Administration of the Common School Fund is by the state land board as trustee, and the Division of State Lands acts as their administrative arm to the land board. In 1859, when we became a state, in the Admissions Act, the federal government granted two sections of each township, and this land or lands that were provided in lieu of these two sections were used for schools, were to be used for schools. This is the basis of the trust. At the time of statehood, this amounted to about 3.4 million acres. Today, we have less than a fourth of that land mass remaining in state ownership. The sale of the land itself, or the proceeds from the sale or management of the land, was used to establish the original corpus of the constitutionally created Common School Fund. The Common School Fund itself is created in Article 8, Sections 2 and 5 of the Oregon Constitution. This establishes the fund and tells you the constitutional sources of the fund. It establishes the state land board and directs their management requirements for the fund. It does allow the state land board to use income derived from the Common School Fund to pay their expenses in land management of the constitutional land. It also directs the investment of unexpended monies and requires income from those monies to be applied to schools. And it requires a law, which you have enacted, to provide for the distribution of the Common School Fund. In 1968, there have been a number of amendments to this section of the Constitution, and I'm only going to talk about a couple of the major ones. In 1968, they shifted some of the distributions to earnings on investments, and they shifted funding for the land board from the distributable income to principal income, and it was at this time that they allowed the land board to use a portion of the principal for land management purposes. They also imposed the management standard to manage the lands for the greatest benefit of the people of the state, consistent with conservation of this resource under sound techniques of land management. That all happened in 1968. In 1988, SJR amended the Constitution again and shifted the funding back to, for allowable expenses, back to investment income sources before it was distributed. They also, at that point, allowed investment in the principal in the stock market. The structure of the Common School Fund today, the value is approximately $750 million. The sources of that fund are from three basic sources: constitutional sources, statutory sources, and one that we treat separately, the unclaimed property deposit liability, and I'll go through those a little bit more detail. Constitutional revenue sources can create about 83% of the Common School Fund, or about $595 million is constitutionally derived sources.
Can you give me that number again, please?
$595 million. That's 83%. And that's these revenue sources are proceeds of lands granted to the state in the Admission Acts, clear proceeds of property accruing to the state by a cheat, or if someone dies without leaving a will or heirs, the money escheats to the state after 10 years. Proceeds of all gifts, devises, and bequests made to the state for Common School Fund purposes.
Forget it.
Proceeds of unspecified land or property grants. In other words, if someone grants us property without a specified purpose, it goes into the Common School Fund. Net proceeds of oil and natural gas taxes. 5% of the proceeds of the sale of any federal lands in the state. And revenues from constitutional Common School Fund land investments. The statutory revenue sources, which the legislature has throughout the years directed to the Common School Fund, are about 2% of the Common School Fund, or about $14.6 million. These proceeds are from unclaimed property funds. When those funds are invested, the proceeds go to the Common School Funds. Clear proceeds from certain forfeitures, removal bill permit application fees and civil penalties, proceeds from the sale of submerged and submersible lands, proceeds from mineral and geothermal resource rights on non-Admission Act lands, state or civil penalties for a violation of submerged or submersible land lease requirements, proceeds from treasure trove, which has been pretty small in the last few years, almost zero, and any money, other monies received by the division that are not credited to the distributable income account. A separate piece of money that is in the Common School Fund is the Unclaimed Property Deposit Liability Fund. And we keep this separate because this is money that we received into the Common School Fund under the Unclaimed Property Act. And the purpose of that is to, the fundamental purpose of the act is to restore the money and other assets to Oregon's rightful owners. This consists of, this part of the fund is about $122 million, and it's about 15% of the total fund. The division, the Unclaimed Property Act imposes a fiduciary responsibility on the division to protect those assets until they are claimed by their rightful owners. And the, since 1991, these funds that are turned over to the division are held in perpetuity to allow the owners or their heirs to claim them. Until 1991, there was a 25-year escheat period on this revenue. And in 1991, for a couple of reasons, the legislature opted to eliminate that 25-year period and to hold the funds in perpetuity. The interest earnings on the unclaimed property funds are deposited into the distributable income account, and each year or each biennium are distributed to schools. So they really only sit in the Common School Fund until they're distributed. Another part of the structure of the Common School Fund is the distributable income account. This is a statutory account created within the Common School Fund and includes all the monies that are distributed, or that, well, the monies that go into it are fees and proceeds from state parks, sale of ocean permits and products, all net interest income derived from Common School Fund investments after the payment of our constitutional expenses, and as much of the proceeds derived from the sale of Common School Fund equity investments as the landlord considers appropriate after the payment of our expenses, as much of the dividend income derived from the Common School Fund equity investments as the board considers appropriate, again, after expenses authorized are deducted, and the balance is reinvested in the principal. Interest income derived from the unclaimed property held by the division, and any other monies received by the division and required to be deposited. I don't think there's any others that's not listed. We are required to reimburse losses from investments, and sale of equities must be deducted from the distributable income account and credited to the Common School Fund so that the Common School Fund remains whole. And distribution is made at least semi-annually or more frequently if the State Land Board orders it. Investment of the Common School Fund is through the Oregon Investment Council. They do take into consideration the policies and guidelines of the State Land Board. And Common School Fund expenditures or earnings for the current biennium, and in your blue packet there is a flow diagram, and that's where I took most of these figures. The total projected constitutional earnings for this biennium are $43,271,000,000. The projected statutory earnings are $5,508,000. Unclaimed property deposit liability is expected to be about $20,000,000. It's usually between $15 and $20 million.
I'm not sure I understand that exactly. Does that mean that set up a reserve, assuming that of the amount in there, $20 million of that will get claimed during the period? Is that what that liability reference is?
We collect between $10 to $15 million a year from holders who send money to us for unclaimed property. We get claims for about $10 million a biennium. Mm-hmm. So the net is about $20 million that is held in that kind of separate deposit liability section. But it is kept in the Common School Fund because the interest on it goes to the Common School Fund. Our expenditures projected again are, and these are based on our budget, constitutional expenditures are a total of $17,093,041. Part of this, $5,970,000, is land and waterway program costs. Capital maintenance and improvement, we hope, is $366,000 depending on fires. And probably the biggest part of our constitutional expenses are forestry costs of $10,757,000. Those costs are for management of the Elliott State Forest, which is a constitutional asset. Mm-hmm. Our statutory expenditures total about $7 million. The statutory program costs are $5,140,000, exclusive of the unclaimed property program cost, which is about $2 million more. We are anticipating and have taken Common School Fund distribution allowed in our budget was $31.2 million for the biennium. So about $15 million a year. This is based on our current land board policy of a minimum distribution of about 2% of the value of the Common School Fund, with a range of distribution being between 2 to 5%, and based on the year-over-year return, when the return reaches at least 6%, with a maximum distribution of 5%, and the land board has taken anything above that 5% in the last couple of years and reinvested it. And finally, DSL operating costs for the agency all also come out of the statutory and constitutional revenue streams. We are not a general fund agency. They come out of these revenue streams. And that's it, unless you have questions.
Are there any questions? Representative Hayden.
Representative King has proposed an additional on the accelerated harvest of state timber. Would it be possible to distribute more than 5% from the common school fund? If I see you have a maximum distribution of 5%, if you were to get found money, a windfall from the sale of timber or surplus state lands, could you constitutionally distribute more than 5%?
Yes, if it was income or proceeds from the land, yes.
Then what does it mean, maximum distribution, 5%?
That's just that they have opted to...
That's an administrative...
Yes.
Okay.
In their policy.
Representative Witt.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this 5% is simply a policy that's been adopted by the land board. It could have been 15 or 20%. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, it could be higher as long as we don't dip into the principal. We are constrained by the same constitutional legal issues as the Attorney General tells us who you are.
A follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
And how do you define the principal? Does that include accumulated earnings that have been retained in the fund?
Yes.
How so? Why?
Don, you want to...
It's your time to jump in.
I knew it was
a button more.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, my name is Don Arnold. I'm Chief Counsel of the General Counsel Division, Department of Justice. And we're revisiting an old question here. This is an issue that I think Legislative Council and the Department of Justice may take a different view on. But essentially, our position comes from both the language of the constitutional provision and particularly the last sentence in there, which describes what funds are available for distribution, and almost as importantly, the history of that provision. That language comes from an amendment, I believe, in 1988. And the legislative history that accompanied both the constitutional amendment and some implementing statutes that were enacted at the same time that were that took effect only if the amendment took effect make it pretty clear that what was intended was that any undistributed income that is plowed back into the common school fund becomes a part of the common school fund and is intended in turn to generate additional income, additional revenue that would be available for distribution. So that's where we reach the conclusion.
So follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, please.
So that's based upon statute, your conclusion?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, no. It's based on the language of the Constitution and the history of that constitutional provision. The language of the statute simply provides further evidence that that was the intent at the time that that provision was adopted.
Can you tell us what specific language of the Constitution that you are basing this opinion on?
Yes, it's the last sentence of Section 2, Subsection 2. The remainder of the income derived from the investment of the Common School Fund shall be applied to support of the primary and secondary schools.
Yes.
And your conclusion from that is that if you don't use all of the earnings in a given time period, that you then forego ever using those earnings other than earnings from those earnings?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, that's correct, because I think under both trust law and under general understanding of what constitutes income, once you have converted what was at one time income into a new investment, it's It's changed form. It's not income any longer.
Mr. Chairman, I just have to comment that the extrapolation that's made from that language to that conclusion is just, to me, is inconceivable. And what the Constitution says is it says the fund has to be used for education. And this is a case where we have earnings that were generated that were not used in a particular biennium, and now the argument's being made that the constitutional language makes it impossible to use those dollars other than earnings from those dollars. And I'm having an extreme difficult time with that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Wood. Don, I guess, does the Constitution anywhere in this provision that you're referencing, does it define income in any way?
Mr. Chair, no, it doesn't.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hayden.
Well, it would seem to me that the argument would be moot anyway, because I think what is proposed is for the state land board to invest that money at interest and get the money back. So certainly, constitutionally, they would not be prohibited from investing that money at a market rate of interest, which is what the legislature proposes to do, to borrow money from the common school fund and repay it with arm's length interest.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, the land board, well, there are some statutes that regulate what kind of investments can be made, but the statutes can certainly be changed by the legislature. And I agree, if the legislature authorizes loans as an investment of the fund, and if, in your words, if it's an arm's length transaction, that is, it is properly secured and there's a reasonable expectation that there's going to be repayment and the return on the investment is comparable to what the fund is otherwise earning, I don't see a problem with that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hayden. Don, I wanted to ask you about the three categories of monies that are in the fund. There's the statutory revenue sources, the constitutional revenue sources, which sort of skipping over the disagreement we might have with your office's interpretation of the word income becoming part of the constitutional revenue sources. And then we move down to the unclaimed property deposit,
right?
That $122 million, I think. Even ignoring the constitutional portions of that fund, if the legislature decided that it was in the best interest of K-12 education to borrow some portion of money from the common school fund, again, at a reasonable return that those monies otherwise would have earned to the benefit of the fund, to be paid back in some reasonable period of time, couldn't we borrow from that $122 million pot without ever even having to cross the constitutional threshold of what's defined as income?
Mr. Chair, I think the short answer is yes. And I was going to go through each of these categories of funds, but maybe I can skip over that, and because the real money here on the statutory side is the unclaimed property. But let me just say, with regard to all of the other statutory categories, from our look so far, and we were only asked about this in the last couple of days, but from what we have seen so far, we don't see any impediments to legislature taking the money in the fund that's derived from those statutory sources and either borrowing it or simply redirecting it, removing it from the fund and applying it to the use of schools now.
Well, I would think that, and everybody might have their own view, but if this is an option that we choose to go down as one of the ways of covering sort of the short-term problem we have with respect to funding K-12 in this biennium, I certainly wouldn't, and I don't think many of the people who've been talking about this issue like the idea of sort of taking the money out in a one-time way and spending it. And I wonder about the requirement that you hold these funds in perpetuity for the people who own them. In that respect, I think we're essentially, if we had just taken it and we agreed not to repay it, we sort of spent other people's money.
Well,
and 2 months later when they show up at the door saying, hey, what happened to that return I forgot to collect? I don't think we want to be in the business of telling them we already spent it unless we've got some plan to pay it back.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's a very good point. And as I said, I want to deal with all of the categories, statutory categories other than unclaimed property, and then I'll come to unclaimed property now, because it is more complicated, and in part because of the in perpetuity language. Oregon operates under the Uniform Unclaimed Property Act, which has been adopted by a number of states. And under that act, the state actually doesn't hold title to this unclaimed property money. It acts as custodian to the money, holding it available, as you mentioned, in perpetuity for whoever the rightful owners are, whenever they may show up. And a claimant could come in 100 years from now under current law, and you know, if they could prove that they were entitled to money, they'd get it.
Well, let me ask you about that, and I hope we can sort of do this as a dialogue, because as the questions come to me, I want to ask you. And that was the whole purpose under the old common law for the concept of escheat. So why did we do away with that in 91?
Well, good question. My guess is it's because that was necessary to adopt the Uniform Act, because we, under that act, we have agreements with some other states where we cooperate and send money back and forth. But I don't know the reason why. But I don't think there would be an insurmountable legal problem with going back to the earlier system, and that is putting some kind of a deadline for submitting a claim to the money. And the earlier system was 25 years, but I don't think there's anything magic about that number. The complicating factor here is, and I think the legislature could do that by statute, the complicating factor is I think you would need to have some kind of a grace period or a phase-in period before that 25-year period took effect in order to give those claimants or potential claimants who might be over the 25 years or very close to it notice and an opportunity to get a claim in. So theoretically, what you could do is adopt a statute that sets a 25-year cutoff period for submitting a claim for monies in the fund, have that law take effect or have that limitation period take effect a year from now or 9 months from now, some reasonable period of time. And then any monies that had been unclaimed at that point and that had been in the fund longer than whatever your cutoff period was, I think are yours to, you know, to use.
Let me ask it again another way, though. Do you see any impediment from maybe not even changing that aspect of the fund, but simply not spending the money, but
just borrowing
a portion of the money with a plan time to repay, knowing that in an average biennium we get about, what, $10 million worth of claims on a fund that currently has 122. If we wanted to borrow $50 or $100 million from that with a repayment period over, say, 5, 6, 10 years, you know, the money would likely be there to meet anybody's claims when the time came for them to be met.
Representative Williams, Mr. Chair, I won't say you couldn't do that. I mean, we really haven't thought about that issue. The only thing that gives me pause is the fact that the state doesn't hold title to the money. So what you're really doing is lending someone else's money. But it could be, if you made sure you retained enough money in the fund to meet any, you know, any claims that might come in during that period, it might work. I would want to think about that.
Representative Hayden.
As I recall from hearing the budgets and ways and means, the interest on that does not accrue to the property owner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, that's correct. The interest goes into the distributable account and is distributed to schools in probably in the year that it's earned.
So, Mr. Chairman, so by loaning the property owner's assets, we would not be depriving them of anything of value. they would not be losing investment income.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, that's correct, because they're not entitled to any investment income.
Thank you.
Are there more questions for our friends from Division of State Lands? You got out of here without saying anything. Okay, thank you. OG, or the council. Okay. Let's bring up our friends from Legislative Council. Council Chamoff and Council Hunt, it's good to see you both.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. Greg Chamoff and Cindy Hunt from the Office of Legislative Council. We've provided you with a sheet that contains the pertinent constitutional provisions, also a memorandum that describes in a somewhat more narrative form than what you received from the Division of State Lands, a description of the Common School Fund, the laws governing the fund, and the actions that the Legislative Assembly might take affecting the uses of the fund. I think for purposes of a presentation, we can narrow down what we have to say to simply discussing briefly the one point of disagreement that we have with the Department of Justice, because I think at least as to the courses available to the legislature, we are in agreement except for that one point. And I want to preface my remarks by saying that Mr. Arnold's interpretation of the Constitution is not inconceivable. It's entirely reasonable. This is an area in which we believe that reasonable minds could differ. They happen to in this case. There are certainly have been issues where we've had an opinion. The Attorney General has had another opinion. And we don't think reasonable minds could differ. A particular ethics investigation comes to mind. But this is not one of those cases. The Constitution, when it was amended in 1988, changed the requirement that interest go to be spent for public schools and changed that to income. And the department does not read income to include the profit made on the sale of stock. We do. And part of the reason that we do is in tandem with the referral that went to the people was an amendment to the distributable income account that accumulated for that account the profits on the sale of stock. And that's our point of departure. But as to what income may really mean, I think if we were drafting that again, we'd try to come up with some definition. If you look at Black's Law Dictionary, there are over 35 possible definitions of the word income. And
which one will the Supreme Court use, counsel?
I don't have a coin with 35 sides.
Only one I care about.
We don't know. We've given you what we think is our best interpretation of the law, but we do want to caution you that the department's interpretation is certainly a very reasonable way to read it.
On the Mr. Chamoff, if I could, on the other issue, assuming we sidestepped the constitutional arm wrestling about whether or not income becomes part of the corpus or these earnings become part of the corpus and therefore then not directable or borrowable, do you agree generally with the dialogue that Mr. Arnold and I had about the other sources? In other words, the legislature's ability to craft a statute which would allow, for example, borrowing against the unclaimed properties portion of the fund with some sort of a repayment schedule, maybe even going back to some adoption of a period in which you can't come back and make a claim against those funds forever if they chose to do that. But do you agree generally that the legislature has the authority to make that kind of a borrowing against the fund with some sort of a repayment?
Mr. Chair, yes. I, other than the definition of income, I think I agree with everything that Mr. Arnold said.
Okay. Ms. Hunt, do you have anything you want to add?
No, I don't.
I want to mostly commend you today for wearing a jacket that actually matches the chairs. for a while you sat over there, and you were like a chameleon, you know? I almost didn't even see that you were there.
It's a talent.
Yeah.
70s green.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Greg, if the legislature chose to, through statute, chose to have the common school fund, some of the dollars from the common school fund borrowed, with the provision that is paid back over X number of years, presumably 6 years or thereabouts, does this issue of this definition of income go away?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, yes.
So in your opinion, I mean, these dollars are subject to being borrowed with the, in statutory language that requires them to be paid back, and we don't, in your opinion, this disagreement that we just had here suddenly becomes moot.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, so long as you're talking a loan and not simply taking the money and running, we don't have a dispute.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions for counsel? Well, with that,
thank you.
Thank you both. We are going to adjourn, or yes, not adjourn, recess the meeting for lunch recess, and we will start at 1:30.
The governor at 1:30.
The governor will be here at 1:30, so I'd ask all of you to be here on time so we can start promptly at 1:30.